Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomé River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Whoa. Thank you so much, Blood River Radio family, for holding on. I'm just sitting here looking at my brand new laptop. It's like a toy. I've been pulling up so many articles tonight. And Ben and Sister Monica said that I would never be the same. I got for Christmas a big old laptop. But anyway, I'm back to reality now. And we have the professor himself coming in here, the Bitter Ender. Just talked to him today. And believe it or not, he had part of a sword left. It wasn't all the way destroyed. I just don't know what in the hell we're going to do. We tried everything, but his excuse was, I don't know if I'll buy it or not. He said they don't make them like they used to. But I don't know, man. We tried a few of them ourselves out, and you could literally cut through. Well, I cut through a 55-gallon drum with the sucker. It went right through it like butter, but I don't know what the hell he's doing these swords. But anyway, he's back in the studio now, and he's teaching, the course number is 7107. That's the junior, that's the postgraduate course. In Confederate history. So you better hang on. Don't go anywhere because the Bitter Ender gets really pissed when people try to leave class early. So
anyway. That's it. We got electric wire across the door there. We don't have anybody leaving class early.
He got that right. There's only one way out of class. That's with a body bag, man, or the Bitter Ender's okay. So anyway, Bitter Ender, take us away tonight, brother. And I know you're going to make it spellbinding class as you always do.
Well, first of all, a Merry Christmas to you, Eddie, to our staff there, to Lizzie, all the good people that put this show on and do a great job every week, and we want to wish a Merry Christmas to all of our listeners all over the country. So I hope everybody's doing well and going to eat well and have a lot of presents, and the main thing is to be with your family and friends on Christmas. I've always thought that's the greatest thing about it, to get to see all. I remember growing up, grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins would all get together at Christmas time, and that was just so much fun to see everybody again. So I hope everybody gets a chance to do that. So as you said, we're going to have a little Confederate history tonight. We talked about it earlier on the phone about going over the Confederate Constitution and pointing out the differences between the Confederate Constitution and the U.S. Constitution. And I think the Confederate Constitution was a lot better, not necessarily because it was written by Southerners, because the first one was written by Southerners as well. But they had about 80 years to look at the old one and say, you know, that was pretty good on paper. It was a good idea, but it didn't work out too well. So we're going to start from scratch. We're not going to have to amend it. We're going to start with a blank piece of paper and write up a new Constitution. We're going to correct a lot of the errors. So that's one thing we're going to cover. Another thing I'd like to cover and kind of start off this segment with, this is the month of December, and there were a lot of important events that took place during our war for Southern independence in the month of December. And we'll back it up a little bit. In September of 1862, the big battle at Sharpsburg, Maryland was fought, and the Yankees call it Antietam, but we call it Sharpsburg. And it was pretty much a drawn battle. Lee was backed up against the Potomac River. McClellan had received a copy of Lee's orders that an officer had carelessly dropped as the Confederates were going through Frederick, Maryland. And one of McClellan's staff officers, or it was found and sent up the chain of command to one of McClellan's staff officers, and they would have probably just thrown it away and say, well, it was a trick or something. But this staff officer and the person that wrote it in the Confederate Army had been at West Point together, and he recognized the handwriting and knew it was legitimate. So he passed it on to McClellan, who had a severe case of the slows, and all of a sudden he got moving real fast because now he knew that Lee's army was split up. And so he moved quickly towards the passes in South Mountain and trying to trap Lee's army before they could all get across the Potomac, and fought that huge battle in September around the town of Sharpsburg, Maryland. And it wasn't a Confederate defeat, but it stopped the Confederate advance into Maryland. And well, originally it was going into Pennsylvania and stopped that. And after a day of sitting there and staring at each other and seeing a battlefield just covered with dead and wounded bodies, Lee's army that next night withdrew back across the Potomac And McClellan's Army of the Potomac was so beat up, they had no desire to go after them. But it wasn't a defeat, and that's what the Yankee Army had been getting all through 1862 up until that point. And that was Lincoln's excuse to issue his Emancipation Proclamation that was supposed to free all the slaves and paint the U.S. Army and Lincoln's communists as the good guys, because they said, we're going to free the slaves, which meant that obviously the South wanted to keep them slaves, which it didn't. But that's the way Lincoln was such a great politician. He could twist words around and come up with political nonsense that made it look like we were the bad guys. And the whole purpose of it was not to free the slaves. Let's get one thing straight. Lincoln and the Northern people didn't care one ounce about the blacks. In fact, they passed black codes, so where blacks could not live in the North. Or in some states, they couldn't even spend the night there. They had to keep moving and get out of the state. They did not want the freed slaves coming north because they'd take jobs away from them, from the workers in the North. And the segregation laws and the Jim Crow laws that they always throw at the South actually started in the North. But if you read the Emancipation Proclamation, it says it applies only to those states in rebellion against the Union, which meant the Confederate states where Lincoln had no power. It would be like President Trump passing a resolution or an executive order that applies to communist China. I mean, how's he going to enforce it in communist China? They tell him to go dye his hair yellow or something like that. And it also exempted areas that were occupied by the Union Army. So there were five states that were still in the Union: Delaware, Maryland, West Virginia, Kentucky, and Missouri, where slavery was legal. It didn't apply to them. It only applied to the ones in the Deep South. And so it was just a political ploy. It was meant to keep England and France out of the war on the side of the Confederacy, because they had both abolished slavery. And so by saying, we're fighting to free the slaves, then obviously the bad guys in the South must be fighting to keep them slaves, which we weren't. But, you know, that's what politicians do. And, you know, the news media back then picked up on it. They were as crooked back then as they are today. And so that was the emphasis was on the North is fighting to free all these poor, horribly treated dark people. And the South was obviously, and according to their logic, fighting to keep them. Then, and here's where we get into December. That was issued in September, and it didn't go into effect until January 1, 1863. So what Lincoln wanted was for all of the federal armies that were out in the field to take the offensive and win a smashing victory over these evil, horrible Confederate traitors that had just out to destroy the Union and blah, 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 and show them that they were winning because he had issued this phony emancipation nonsense. So the Army of the Potomac under Ambrose P. Burnside was ordered to advance against Robert E. Lee in central Virginia, and Burnside did that. And he decided to march and ford across the Rappahannock River and attack Lee somewhere, they thought, around Fredericksburg, Virginia. Jeb Stuart's cavalry was so good, they always kept the federal army off balance and in the dark about where Lee's army actually was. So they decided to march down to Fredericksburg, cross the river there, and catch Lee and have the Army of the Potomac, the Union Army, sitting between Lee and Richmond. Well, it took them too long to get down there. The Confederates weren't asleep. They knew exactly what was going, and Lee started pulling his troops together and took up a strong, strong defensive position on the hills to the west of Fredericksburg. And then when they tried to put pontoons across the river, Confederate snipers were picking them off and making it almost impossible to get across the river. And they finally did. It took them 2 or 3 days to finally get the army across the river, and then another day to get it sorted out to make the attacks, and then another day to loot the town of Fredericksburg and steal everything they could get their hands on. And they had Union soldiers jumping up and down on top of pianos and just smashing them, and smashing some of these portraits that were painted during the Revolutionary War, and taking any silverware or anything of value out of the homes in Fredericksburg. Oh, and then, by the way, Then on the 13th of December, they got around to finally fighting the battle and attacking Lee's position up on top of those hills, and they got slaughtered. It was just a shooting gallery. And that was where Lee gave that famous quote after seeing the destruction that his riflemen and artillery had played upon the Union Army down on the plain below the hills there, just as they came out of the town of Fredericksburg. Lee said, "It is well that war is so terrible, or we should grow too fond of it." And it was. It was a wipeout. So that was December 13th. And we'll come back with a couple of the other battles that were also fought in different parts of the country after our break.
Well, I can't wait to hear it. I know where our family can't wait either. So be right back, folks.
Introducing Managed IT Services from NPI. We offer top-notch data backup and recovery, email spam protection, and network security tailored to your needs and budget. With 20-plus years of experience in the medical field, our HIPAA-certified consultants know what it takes to protect sensitive information. Don't settle for less. Give us a call at 801-706-6980 and experience the difference with Managed IT Services. Remember, your IT support should be fast, efficient, and reliable.
I'm Pastor Everett Ramsey, pastor of Faith Baptist Church. A congregation of God's covenant people, informed Christians know that we are at the brink of a long-planned one-world government being executed that will not tolerate true Christian faith. There is a way to stop it. Our church has used God's spiritual weapons of warfare many times over the years, and in every case that was properly executed, the Church of Jesus Christ has been delivered. It is called the Court of Divine Justice. David used it many times. Read Psalm 37, Psalm 109. It includes truthful information, repentance, and imprecatory prayers. Blood River Radio is the only radio station I know that supports action based on truth about lies concerning the Confederacy, the Civil Rights Movement, the German people, the true Holocaust, and who the true covenant people of God are, and the sins and failures of the churches, if any of these. This means anything to you, and it should, then please say so with your money, as well as prayers. You may obtain information from us about the Courts of Divine Justice by sending your offering and request to Blood River Radio, and we take none of the money.
Introducing PrepStartsNow.com, your ultimate guide to readiness and peace of mind. We offer practical preparedness tools, training, and education to take your family's household readiness to the next level. Browse the prep shop for essential products, check out our planning guides, and stay informed with our prep blog. Visit PrepStartsNow.com and subscribe to our emails for exclusive offers, new products, and future events. Remember, preparedness begins with PrepStartsNow.com.
Dear Blood River Radio family, Gene Zorro, I've attempted to ask him to talk about what we talked about during the break, but that's strictly the bitter ender's discretion. I don't want to get him off.
Well, yeah, we can cover that. We try to put out information to our listeners, and the main thing is to give our listeners ammunition to fire back at these people that are such experts on the history of the war for Southern independence or the South, and all they can do is run the South down. Sam Dixon, I heard him speak at the American Renaissance Conference back in November out at Montgomeryville State Park, and his topic was Whitey on the Psychiatrist's Couch. And he was talking about liberalism is really a mental deficiency, that they cannot face facts, that they have to come up with these weird ideas of liberalism to get through life and get over factual information that they can't understand. And he said, it's hard to figure out what is wrong with them mentally. And he was talking about where he lives in Atlanta, the richest part of Atlanta and the poorest part of Atlanta always vote the same, vote for liberal Democrats. And you can't understand why. You could almost understand why the blacks in the poorest part of Atlanta, they get promised that, well, you elect us and we're going to do this and do this and do this, which the Democrats never do. But the blacks, you know, vote 98-99% of their vote for the liberal Democrats. But then why do these liberal whites vote like the worst section in Atlanta? And he said, because it's a mental deficiency that they have. They have this guilt complex. And just like the fellow you got into it with in New York, and talking about the marker there for slavery in New York, and he didn't like the idea that you were pointing it out, that there was slavery in the North as well as there was slavery in the South. But remember, in all 13 colonies, slavery was legal. In all 13 states, after those 13 colonies became states, slavery was legal. And the biggest slave importing cities were in the North, like Boston and New Bedford, and Providence, Rhode Island was the biggest. New York, Philadelphia, all these ports on the East Coast up North were hauling slaves out of Africa and bringing over here and selling them to the South. And there was not one single slave ship that was ever chartered out of a Southern port, not Wilmington, not Savannah, not Charleston, not Mobile, not New Orleans, none of them. They all were brought in here by the Northern slave ships. And a lot of these big wheeler dealers that made their fortune off the slave trade then turned around, and with their guilty conscience, they gave huge endowments to these schools in the Northeast to start Brown and Yale and Harvard and Princeton and all of these Ivy League schools that have their nose stuck up in the air and look down their nose at the South and all us, you know, just serfs that work on the land. Their school was put in place by slave importers and people that own shipping companies that brought the slaves over here. So they are very selective in their history up there. And so that's why that guy got bent out of shape when you brought up the fact that there was a monument to slavery in the state of New York, which it was. It was a slave state at one time. And they say, we got rid of slavery. We got rid of slavery. Hey, never underestimate Mr. Yankee's worship of the dollar. Yeah, they got rid of slavery, all right. But the way they did it, they didn't pass a law that said, okay, everybody's free at 8 o'clock Monday morning. When they got rid of slavery in Massachusetts, they sold their slaves into New York. When New York got rid of slavery, they sold their slaves into Pennsylvania. And when Pennsylvania got rid of slavery, they sold their slaves into Maryland. And that's where it was in 1861. So they don't have any high horse that they need to be riding around on and turn their nose up at the South. So anyway, little side bit of history there. Back to December of 1862. So the Army of the Potomac got hammered at Fredericksburg. So that wasn't a real good introduction to Lincoln's emancipation coming up on the 1st of January. Out west, things didn't go much better either. General Grant was bringing a Union army out of Memphis, going down through central Mississippi to attack Vicksburg. And the idea was he was just going to march into Vicksburg and take that and shut off the Mississippi River for the Confederates to use from supplies coming from the west. Well, his plans kind of changed. There was a certain individual that had never gone to West Point, but turned out to be probably one of the best cavalry commanders in American history by the name of Nathan Bedford Forrest, that went across the Tennessee River, got into West Tennessee, and destroyed the Mobile and Ohio Railroad, which was Grant's supply line into Mississippi. And then another Confederate officer, Earl Van Doren, raided in behind Grant and burned up his supply depot at Holly Springs, Mississippi. So with no supplies, Grant had to turn around and trot back to Memphis. Now, he sent an expedition down the Mississippi to the mouth of the Yazoo River and then tried to go down to take Vicksburg from the north under William T. Sherman. And Sherman and the Union fleet landed north of Vicksburg and unloaded Sherman's men at a place called Chickasaw Bayou. And I don't think Sherman knew that bayou is another word for swamp. And so they were unloaded in this swamp and struggling. Yeah, well, now this is December, and the water's up, and these guys are wading out, trying to wade out of this place in cold water and up to their waist in water, and the only way out of there was on a raised road to get out of that swamp, and that just set them up for that causeway, set them up for the Confederates that were up on the Chickasaw Bluffs, or they also called it Walnut Hills, And when they tried to get out of there, the Confederates just absolutely mowed them down. And Sherman's men had to turn around and scurry back through the swamp and struggle onto the boats and get out of there. I'm very proud to say that two of my ancestors were up on the Chickasaw Bluffs. Corporal Henry McGee of the 50th Tennessee Infantry, Company H, 50th Tennessee Infantry, and another one, Captain Elbert Sexton, who was the company commander for Company H, 50th Tennessee Infantry. They'd been sent down there from the Army of Tennessee to defend Vicksburg, and they were waiting for Sherman's men when they came struggling up out of this swamp. And so that escapade, which was on the 27th and 28th of December, 1860, that was a disaster. That sure didn't help out Lincoln bragging about his Emancipation Proclamation very much. It was coming up on July 1. So we had a disaster with the Army of the Potomac at Fredericksburg. We had a disaster with Billy the Torch Sherman at Chickasaw Bayou and Forrest Raid into West Tennessee. And then the next one that came along at the same time, Lincoln ordered that. So that was one order that failed for Lincoln, was going down the river there to take Vicksburg. The other order he sent out was to the commander of the Federal Army in Nashville under William Rosecrans to move out of Nashville and attack Braxton Bragg and the Confederate Army of Tennessee. And all they knew was he was somewhere in Middle Tennessee. So move out of Nashville, attack Bragg, get him finished off by third week in December, by Christmas anyway, and we'll have a big victory. We can celebrate this Emancipation Proclamation. So Rosecrans starts tippy-toeing out of Nashville. He's got orders, but he's not real eager to get out in the countryside.
He
didn't know that Forrest wasn't out there, and he didn't know that Forrest had left Bragg's army and been sent west across the Tennessee River and into West Tennessee. So he didn't want to mess around out in Middle Tennessee somewhere, out in the boondocks with Forrest out there. So he very carefully plots out of Nashville, looking over his shoulder in both directions, and Joseph Wheeler, that was the cavalry that was left with the Army of Tennessee, made a ride completely around Rosecrans' army, kind of like Jeb Stuart did around McClellan back in June of 62. Wheeler did the same thing. In fact, it was even longer than Jeb Stuart's ride around McClellan, and he destroyed a lot more wagon trains and property and so forth than Jeb Stuart did. But you don't hear as much about that as you hear about Stuart's raid around McClellan. And not only that, but John Hunt Morgan then swung around north of Nashville and cut the railroad lines, the Louisville and Nashville Railroad, and burned up the timbers in the tunnel north of Nashville up near Greenbrier, Tennessee, up there in Ridgetop, and it collapsed the tunnel, and it shut down that railroad for over 6 months before they could repair that. So Rosecrans now was out in Middle Tennessee with virtually no supplies, and he was going to have to fight a battle quickly, or else he was going to starve to death in the winter out there. So he finally pulled up his army near Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in Middle Tennessee, and on December 31st, Bragg's Army of Tennessee attacked Rosecrans, and they drove the Federals back into a really sharp V. The Federal Army, and this is another one that they call the Battle of Stones River. We call it the Battle of Murfreesboro. But Rosecrans' Federal Army was pinned back in a really sharp V with one flank backed up against Stones River, and the Confederates holding the other flank, pushing him back across the Nashville-Murfreesboro Road and the Nashville-Chattanooga Railroad. And it looked like Rosecrans was about to be finished off, and probably Bragg could have finished him off. The problem with Bragg was he could plan a battle, he could train troops, he could lay out an excellent plan, but then once the first shot was fired, he went into some kind of a funk or whatever you want to call it, a mental breakdown. He could not adjust to what was happening on the battlefield. Oh. And if his plan wasn't followed perfectly, he just kind of sulked or went into a trance or whatever you want to call it. He couldn't adjust. And most military historians will tell you, your battle plan goes out the window as soon as the first shot's fired. So you better have a plan B. So we'll come back and tell about what happened on the second and third day at the Battle of Murfreesboro in 1862 at Murfreesboro, Tennessee.
Well, I can't wait to hear that when we come back. In fact, I got to make a favorable comment when we come back. Be right back, folks.
Exposing corruption, informing citizens, pursuing liberty. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
Hold on, our bodies. No way around it. Whether it's sitting hours on end at your computer or working a physical job, over time your body pays the price. There is, however, an effective way to turn back the clock on pain, Relief Factor. Developed by doctors, Relief Factor helps support your body's response to inflammation. The difference? Instead of masking pain, Relief Factor helps eliminate it for good. And it's 100% drug-free. If the pains that come with living a full life are affecting you, do as so many others have. Turn back the clock on pain with Relief Factor. Their three-week quick start is just $19.95, less than a dollar a day. When you feel good, it's amazing how much more you get out of life. So visit ReliefFactor.com or call 1-800-4-RELIEF. That's 1-800-4-RELIEF. Try it for only $19.95. While we can't stop aging, not yet, we can stop pain. Turn back the clock with Relief Factor.
Environmentalists trying to force the feds to release images of dead orca whales and other marine mammals entangled in commercial fishing nets off the West Coast.
Activists filed suit in Alaska and California after the government allegedly failed to honor multiple Freedom of Information Act requests. The Washington-based conservation group Oceana seeks the images as part of a campaign to raise public awareness about the harmful effects of trawl fishing in federally managed waters. The group has long complained for tighter controls on such fishing, which involves large boats dragging massive nets on or near the ocean floor. Rich Thomason reporting.
California regulators approving a controversial proposal to delay the closure of the Aliso Canyon National Gas Facility. It is the site of the United States' largest known methane leak. Breaking news and analysis, townhall.com. An inflation gauge that is closely watched by the Federal Reserve barely rose last month. That a sign that price pressures cooled after 2 months of sharp gains.
Prices rose just 0.1% from October to November. Excluding the volatile food and energy categories, prices also ticked up just 0.1% after 2 months of outside 0.3% gains. The milder inflation figures arrived 2 days after Federal Reserve officials rocked financial markets by revealing that they now expect to cut their key interest rate just 2 times in 2025, down from 4 in their previous estimate.
That is Jeremy House reporting. Amazon delivery drivers and Starbucks employees on strike in a handful of cities as they seek to exert pressure on the two major companies to recognize them as unionized employees. More on these stories at townhall.com.
I'm Monica Schaefer from Canada, a former political prisoner. Here at Blood River Radio, we are not afraid to tell the truth and shame the devil. Our mission is to fight against white genocide. We do that by exposing the lies. We talk about the American Civil War. We talk about the vilification of German people and, by extension, all white people. And we even talk about that linchpin lie, the Holocaust. Deception by the alien enemy within has brought us whites to our knees. My last words at the Schaefer's speech crime trial in Germany were, quote, "If there was a law forbidding us to breathe, we would break that law immediately just to live. And so it is with this law. We must break this law in order to survive and thrive as a people." Unquote. Please donate to Blood River Radio and help keep us on the air.
Former Sheriff Richard Mack recounts in his book, The Proper Role of Law Enforcement, how he came to realize while working as a beat cop how wrong the all-too-common orientation of police officers is when they think of their job as being to write tickets and arrest people. Richard Mack tells of his personal transformation from by-the-number cop to constitution-conscious defender of citizen safety and freedoms. Learn what it really means to serve and protect. Purchase your copy at cspoa.org. That's cspoa.org.
Do you know what is great about America? Ask an immigrant. Ask an Immigrant is a new podcast dedicated to helping Americans, especially our youth, value, appreciate, and be grateful for the freedoms we have here in America. Join host Lydia Wallace Nuttall as she interviews immigrants from around the world to discover their inspiring personal stories about why they came to America. To learn more about why America is the most prosperous, greatest country in the world, download the Loving Liberty app or go to lovingliberty.net.
The Innis is a 44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and would blow your head clean off. You've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, Bunk?
Okay, we were back, and Eddie and I were talking during the break. He said he wanted to thank me for bringing up the names of some of these Confederate officers that a lot of people have never heard of. And that was true during the war. The whole emphasis was on the Eastern Theater, but the land between Washington, D.C. and Richmond, Virginia, about 90-some-odd miles there, and the Confederate government focused on that, of course, because Richmond was the capital. It had been moved from Montgomery up to Richmond when Virginia seceded. And that was the whole emphasis, was to defend the Capitol. And the whole idea was in the Confederate government that we would be able to fight a conventional type war and destroy the Army of the Potomac in one great big battle and then march into Washington, D.C. or threaten Washington, D.C. and sue for peace and gain our independence. And it just never happened. The South didn't have the manpower to fight a war of attrition. And so a lot of the emphasis, as I said, was in the Eastern Theater up there. And the Confederate government, unfortunately, kind of overlooked the West, which the Western Theater went from the Appalachian Mountains all the way over to the Mississippi River. And then you had the Trans-Mississippi Department that was on the other side of the river, west of the river. So that got very, very little support out of Richmond. And it was a huge, huge area to cover. When you go all the way from the mountains to the Mississippi, that's the entire length of the state of Tennessee, you have several hundred miles there. And from Kentucky all the way down into central Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia, that was a huge area to defend. And the other thing that hurt that part of the Confederacy was the rivers in that area ran north and south. If you look at the Mississippi, the Tennessee, and the Cumberland River, they were invasion routes right into the heart of the Central Confederacy, while the rivers over in the east, the James River, the Rappahannock, the Rapidan, the Potomac, they all ran east and west. So the Confederates could get behind those rivers there and had a natural barrier to stop the invasion of Virginia. But out here in the west, the rivers ran, like I said, north and south, and ran right straight into the central part of the Confederacy there in Tennessee, of course, the Mississippi, all the way down to the Gulf. And it was a very difficult situation that they had, and the armies were not as big as what they had in the East either. But they had some outstanding officers, and we talked about Bedford Forrest and his raid across the Tennessee River into West Tennessee, took out the Mobile and Ohio Railroad, and that stopped Grant's overland invasion of Vicksburg. And it took him another 6 months to finally get around to down to Vicksburg and lay siege to the fortress there. And then we talked about John Hunt Morgan. And his nickname was the Thunderbolt of the Confederacy. He was a Virginian, from Kentucky. And, of course, they've torn down the John Hunt Morgan statue in Lexington, Kentucky. They don't want that around anymore. And he was a cavalry officer, came up from a lieutenant up to a brigadier general. And we were talking about his raid behind the federal lines and went up into Kentucky and took out the Louisville and Nashville Railroad, which pretty much left Rosecrans, the Union commander that was ordered by Lincoln to move out of Nashville and win this great victory to emphasize Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation on January 1. Well, it took him a long time to get out of Nashville, and then even slower when he found out he didn't have any supplies behind him. And then Joseph Wheeler made a raid all the way around Rosecrans' army. And I think, if I got my numbers correct, burned and destroyed or captured over 300 wagons in supply trains around behind Rosecrans. Dr. Michael Bradley had a great book out. It's called The Raiding Winter, and it talked about Forrest, Van Dorn in Mississippi, Wheeler in Middle Tennessee and John Hunt Morgan up into Kentucky. And what they did to stop the Union armies, and all three of these all hit at about, or excuse me, all four of these cavalry units hit at about the same time, and none of them were even close to the size of the Federal Army, but they hit the supply lines behind the main Federal armies and stopped them. And I asked Dr. Bradley one time when he was giving a talk on that after the program was over, I said, if that was so successful, why couldn't the Confederacy just keep doing that over and over and over again? He said, I do not know. He said, it must have been that mindset that eventually we're going to win this giant tactical, conventional type of battle and destroy the army and march towards Washington, D.C., and get the war over with. But the Confederacy proved that they had the people out in the field that could carry on the type of warfare that would not cause huge loss of life in the South. They didn't need huge amounts of military supplies. They didn't need the British intervention into the war. They could do it on their own. But they never did do it again after that December of 1862. So Rosecrans finally moved out on the 31st of December. He was attacked by Bragg at Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And Bragg, as we said before the break, bent the Federal Army back into a sharp V. They were backed up against Stones River and could almost finish him off. But Bragg, as we said, could plan a battle, initiate it, but then when it didn't go the way he had it planned, he kind of fell apart or went into a daze or something, whatever you want to call it. And he could not figure out how to finish off the Federal Army. He kept attacking the strongest point in the Federal lines, the Round Forest that they called it right there, which were a lot of limestone outcroppings. It was actually kind of a natural fort where the Federal Army placed all of their artillery, and the Confederates threw wave after wave after wave of assaults against it and just got mowed down. So why waste your army doing that? Bring your artillery up, pin them down, and take most of your troops and swing around and attack a position that was very lightly defended. And I think this is what made Nathan Bedford Forrest such a great commander. He had planned a battle, and if it didn't go exactly the way he had it planned, he'd say, okay, we'll go to plan B. We'll hold these people here. We'll take the rest of our troops and swing around behind them and catch them in the flank or in the rear and take them out. We're not going to be stupid enough to attack a real strong position four or five times in a day and litter the whole battlefield with our dead soldiers. What good is that going to do? So anyway, they were pinned back on the 2nd of January. Bragg got some men across the Stones River and tried to take an artillery position away from the Federals. They got caught out in the open, some of John Breckinridge's men, and they took heavy losses over there. Bragg pulled back the next day, withdrew from Murfreesboro and headed back down toward the Duck River in Shelbyville and Tullahoma, Tennessee, about 15 to 20 miles south of Murfreesboro. So Rosecrans, out of all four of these operations that Lincoln had ordered, at Fredericksburg, at Chickasaw Bayou, at Vicksburg, with Grant coming overland to Vicksburg and into Middle Tennessee, that was the only one that was even partially successful. And then, of course, Lincoln, on the 1st of January, went ahead and issued his Emancipation Proclamation that we've talked about. So a lot of things had happened to make that battle at Murfreesboro. Who knows? You know, maybe if it had been a completely rout of Rosecrans' Federal Army and Bragg and the Army of Tennessee had followed them up and marched into Nashville and had retaken Nashville, that was lost to the Federals after the surrender at Fort Donelson on the Cumberland River, and the Federal Army moved into Nashville and took over Nashville in February of 1862, basically without firing a shot, and fortified Nashville. They say that Nashville back then was the most heavily fortified city in the North American continent, next to Washington, D.C., because Nashville was on the Cumberland River, and it had three railroad lines that came in there that could supply the Federal armies all over the Central South. So the Federals knew how important Nashville was to them, and most of the battles that were fought after the fall of Fort Donelson, like Shiloh, like Murfreesboro, like the battles around Chickamauga, at Chickamauga and Chattanooga, those were attempts to recapture Nashville. and even late in the war, when John Bell Hood brought his Army of Tennessee back into Middle Tennessee in December of 1864, 2 years later, that was an attempt to recapture Nashville that had been lost in February of 62. So anyway, that'll give you a little bit of an idea of what happened in December of 1862. Quite a bit going on then. The other thing that we wanted to cover, I'm sorry, Eddie, did you have a question?
Oh, no, I should say so. There was like a heck of a lot going on. I just keep thinking how cold it must have been, man.
Oh, yeah.
I'm telling you, I was just going to say, though, our Confederate troops, they weren't holed up in the city like Nashville. They were, I can imagine.
No, they were out in the field. No.
They had no goose down. They had no thinsulate. I mean, I don't know how the hell they did it. I really don't. But I mean,
they had those big wool overcoats if they could get them. We were talking during the break about John Hunt Morgan, the Thunderbolt of the Confederacy.
Yes.
He raided across the Ohio River, up into Indiana, up into Ohio, and was coming back, and his troops got caught with a gunboat and Federals come closing in behind him. He couldn't get all of them back across the Ohio River. So he stayed with his men, and he was taken prisoner and sent to prison in Columbus, and we'll come back after the break and tell you what happened to him.
Yes, sir. I don't know if you heard the music, but we'll be right back, folks.
In the medical field, IT security is crucial. Our highly skilled consultants are HIPAA certified and have 20 plus years of experience servicing medical clinics, billing and supply companies. We offer comprehensive endpoint protection, guarding your computers and servers against all stages of threats. And with our 24/7 monitoring services, you'll never worry about extensive downtime again. Ready to level up your IT support? Call 801-706-6980 today and discover how great IT services can be with Managed IT Services.
I'm Michael Hill, President of the League of the South. I and my compatriots are Southern Nationalists. We seek the survival, well-being, and independence of the Southern people, our people. The League wants a South that enjoys the sweet fruits of Christian liberty and prosperity, but our current situation won't allow it. We must have our independence from Washington, D.C., and the globalists. The present system cannot be reformed. Without independence, we will continue down this path of destruction. To us, this is not acceptable. I'm asking you, Southern man and woman, to join us today to free the South. Call us at 256-757-6789 or see our website at www.leagueofthesouth.com. God save the South.
The spirit of the American West is alive and well in Range Magazine, the award-winning quarterly devoted to the issues of the American West. Each issue contains informative articles, breathtaking imagery, as well as the culture of cowboy spirit today, and gift ideas, like this year's Buckaroo calendar. Order online from rangemagazine.com. Loving Liberty Network salutes the spirit of the American West at rangemagazine.com.
Dear Blood River Radio family, I tell you what, I was just telling Brother Gene, the bitter ender, that I was really glad that he was going about over some leaders, some cavalry soldiers that I've never heard of. For instance, I've never heard of John Thunderbolt Morgan. And other people like that, I've said that we all know Jeb Stuart, we all know Stonewall, we all know Nathan Bedford Forrest and General Lee, and we give them, and they give them the credit that they deserve. But I'm so glad these people, the unsung heroes, I guess I'll say, I'm so glad he's covering them to educate us, not only that, but to give these people, I know they're dead and gone, but I'm glad that they're getting some recognition, even after they are dead. But anyway, go ahead, Bitter Ender.
Well, we were talking about John Hunt Morgan from Kentucky, and we were talking about that raid up through Indiana and Ohio and coming back across the Ohio River, and part of his men got across and part got trapped on the Ohio side of the river. And Morgan could have gotten across the river, but he stayed to try to get as many of his men across as he could so they wouldn't be captured. And so Morgan and about 30 or 40 of them did get captured, and they got sent to the state prison in Columbus, Ohio. and they think there was a guard that was paid off, or there was somehow they escaped. And Morgan, instead of, they figured they were going to head south and try to get back across the river into Kentucky. So what Morgan did, he headed north and got civilian clothes and caught a train up north of Columbus and was riding back south, because they never thought they'd be going north. They thought they'd be heading south trying to get back to Kentucky. So he's coming on a train from up north, and they're going past Columbus. And he's sitting there, and he's in civilian clothes. And this Yankee officer comes on the train and sits down right next to him, and he says, they go by this prison. They can see the prison. He says, you see that prison over there? That's where they got that rebel raider, John Hunt Morgan. And that's got where they got him for safekeeping. And, of course, he doesn't know Morgan. He's sitting right next to him telling him, that's where they got him for safekeeping. And Morgan says, well, I hope he's as safe as he is right now. So he went on back down south and got back across the Ohio River, and then joined up with his men and reorganized his unit again. But he wound up being killed up in Greenville, up in East Tennessee, up there, and rode into pretty much a federal ambush there in that town, and got killed there. And I've been to that house. There's a house where he was staying, and then the yard outside where he was actually shot and killed. And some people say he had surrendered, and the Yankees just shot him because they got tired of fooling with him. And they figured that was a way to take him out of the war, was shoot him while he was disarmed and as a prisoner. But anyway, so that's what we're talking about in December. And then we wanted to talk a little bit about the Confederate Constitution, which is really an interesting document. I don't think we're going to have time to finish it up this week, so maybe when we come back, I think you said we're going to do a rebroadcast during Christmas week or whatever, but when we come back online live, we'll do finish up our Confederate Constitution. Now, it was formed by the Confederate government that met in Montgomery, Alabama, in February of 1861. And then once Virginia seceded, then the seat of government was moved from Montgomery up to Richmond, Virginia, which was probably not a great idea because it put it within 90 miles of the enemy's capital. And the whole emphasis of the war was on northern Virginia, and the rest of the South was pretty much left on its own. But anyway, that was a decision that was made by the Confederate government. And the idea behind the Confederate government and why they seceded was a lot more than just slavery. One of the main reasons was the same reason that wars have been fought since way back when Ugog hit Mugog over the head with a dinosaur bone out in front of the cave, is about money. Because in the 1850s and 60s, the South had the money, because the South had cotton, and cotton was in the 1850s and 60s what oil is today. And you think of the Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Dubai and the United Arab Emirates and how much money they have over there, and the huge buildings and hotels and gambling casinos and everything they make over there. Yes. That's the kind of money the South had back then. And the South was paying the budget for the federal government. As we mentioned earlier, the federal budget in 1860, and I've heard two or three different numbers, $102 million to $104 million, something in that range. And we laugh at that today because they blow that off in lunchtime in Washington today. Yes. That's nothing today. But it was a lot of money back then. But say it was $102 million, the South was paying $82 million out of that because of tariffs on imported goods. And the South was an agricultural country, and they sold their cotton to England, and they purchased what they needed from England and France and Spain. But they had high tariffs. The U.S. government put high tariffs on imported goods to protect their industries in the Northeast, and so the South was paying the tab for protecting industry in the Northeast and financing the federal government. So that was one reason why they wanted out. And the other reason was they saw the direction that the federal government was going. The Constitution is just a piece of paper. It's absolutely worthless as just a piece of paper unless people live by it and enforce it. And they saw that the federal government and the growth of the power in the Northeast was getting away from the Constitution and what we had signed on for. They said that all of these governments, state, federal, theoretically, rest on the consent of the government and with sovereignty residing with the people and not in the government. So the power should be lying with the people, and the state governments, as they saw it, were to impose themselves between the individual citizens and a national government if the national government was getting out of line and taking more power than they were legally allowed to have under the Constitution. Now, the Constitution is only as good as the people that enforce it. They said, and then there were several interesting things in the Confederate Constitution. First of all, the preamble. It didn't say we the people. It said that they are the representatives of the we the representatives of the several states assembled do hereby ordain and establish this Constitution. And that was the whole point, was to emphasize that the states were the most important government, and the national government was only to protect our borders, regulate trade, but not interfere with the daily lives of people in the various states. And so that's why they wrote that into into the preamble. They considered the federal government as, what happened was that now in the 1860s, and especially after the Lincoln election and the Republican Party, that the federal government was considered as the superior to the state governments, and they thought that was incorrect. An individual was only a citizen, and they now said that an individual was only a citizen of a national community, and that was regulated through his state and the national government. They thought that was wrong. So they made several changes when they adopted the Confederate Constitution. Number one, they looked at the office of president, and they said, this guy spends his last 2 years in office campaigning for the next 4 years. We're going to fix that. So the president of the Confederate States got a six-year term, but you could only be president once. So your job is to be the executive branch of the government, not campaign for your reelection. So the president got a six-year term, but only one time. And in the government that was set up in February of 1861 in Montgomery, the Confederate high political officials and the military officers, rank of general, brigadier general and above, were provisional officers in the government and provisional officers in the military. Their term, Jefferson Davis's term and the military terms, it automatically expired after 1 year because they wanted to see what kind of job they were going to do. And Jefferson Davis was out after a year. Robert E. Lee was out after a year. Jackson, all of these other people, their military rank or their political rank ended after a year. So if they weren't doing a good job, they could tell some. They didn't have to have a court-martial to get rid of somebody in the military or impeach the president or something. They could just say to somebody, well, we thank you very much, but we don't think you're doing a good job as an officer out in the field. We're going to have you in charge of the button-making factory down in Valdosta, Georgia. I think that's your strong suit right there. So if you look at the Confederate seal that they had, it says February 22nd, 1862. So that was the official government that started in the Confederacy, not 1861, but February 22nd, George Washington's birthday, 1862. So that's when Jefferson Davis's first term started, his six-year term started in February of 1862. But they did give the president a byline veto. And that's one thing the president doesn't have today. If the president wants to veto a bill that's got a lot of pork barrels spending attached to it, he has to veto the whole bill. So you lose your appropriations for the military. You lose some other important things they have, like they're talking about today with this continuing resolution, getting some kind of relief to the people up in the mountains in North Carolina that are freezing. I mean, they are dying and freezing in these tents. Mm-hmm. And FEMA has all of these modular trailers, well heated, well lit, well everything, but they got a big chain link fence around it, so nobody can get in there and get a warm place to stay in the wintertime. And they even have guards. So, but the Confederate president could veto any one thing in that bill and get it out of there and let the rest of it go. Eddie, thanks for the time. I hope
you
put out some good information for our folks, and we'll finish up the Constitution the next program we have.
You put out the best, and I really thank you for that, Gene. I really do, buddy. And I know our family, our Blood River Radio family, loves this hour, and you're one of a kind, brother. Well, people, you heard it. You've sitting in on really and truly an advanced course. You'll never hear any information this good anywhere in any school anywhere in the world, especially not in the Yankee schools and up north. Well, people, like I said, we're going to be taking off next week for doing family business and stuff like that. But I'd just like to say Merry Christmas, and we'll see you sometime as soon as we come back from the Christmas break. Good night, everybody.